The following talk was given by Steve Hagen in Minneapolis on July 21, 1997. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
So, good evening.
Good evening.
And welcome to our final class on Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I want to pick up where we left off at the end of last time. With negative and positive, that's on page 90, I guess. And at the beginning, when I was looking this over again, I just kind of looked at the heading at the beginning of the chapter, where he said, "Big mind is something to express, not something to figure out. Big mind is something you have, not something you seek for." And I was thinking of the conversation that we had last week, what Jila brought up about the unconscious, that isn't it the unconscious that an artist, for example, taps into, where they get that inspiration from? And as I was saying last week, Buddhism, though on occasion, like he uses the term unconscious here once in a while, but to speak of the unconscious, there's no such aspect of mind. Mind is made of consciousness. I mean, the mind is consciousness. The consciousness is the functioning of mind. And if there's mind there, then there's consciousness there. There's no part of mind that is unconscious, so to speak. There might be things that you personally, in your own personal mind, are unconscious of or unaware of. That's certainly true. And part of it is that you're not aware of big mind. Usually when we're in our ordinary state of mind, we're not aware of big mind. We're in our little mind, our ego mind, this is our normal mind, our conceptual mind. This is where most of us spend our life. In such a mind, we never really tap into big mind. Well, we might tap into it in ways, but we're not really aware that we're doing this. And this might seem kind of unconscious or something like that. Something's coming to us, some inspiration, we don't know where it's coming from. But this is just actual mind functioning. It's not your own personal mind, it's just mind itself, which we call big mind. And I think perhaps artists do draw upon big mind. I suspect that the greater the inspiration, the greater the art, the kind of art that actually moves people, and especially people over the centuries, you know, as time goes on, a great painting or a great piece of music or poetry or whatever that lasts over generations of people, that moves people for many generations. This is probably, I wouldn't even say probably, this is my own personal opinion, but I would say that this is an indication that that artist, that writer, that musician, that composer tapped into big mind, the mind of reality itself or the mind of the whole. And to that extent, their own personal, their ego self just kind of steps aside momentarily while they create this great art. Yeah, for example, I just happen to think of this, that Handel, you know, the most famous piece that he wrote, Handel's Messiah, if you know it, it's a huge piece. It goes on for hours. Choral works within it and all of this, and I believe he wrote it in something like two or three weeks. You know, and every bit of it is inspired. It's just wonderful, inspiring music. Moves me completely. You know, every bit of it from beginning to end for hours. And where is this coming from? Well, I suspect that the ego of Handel steps aside, and its big mind itself is speaking here. So I think this is what the artist is capable of tapping into. But perhaps, and I would say perhaps in most cases unconsciously, not fully aware of what's taking place here. What we call enlightenment is the actual seeing of what's taking place, when you can actually, basically what you see is your ego. You see what that is. And you see how that's separated out from virtually everything else. And as a result of seeing that, you see the full structure of reality and how it is. We don't get caught up in things so much with our ego. And we also transcend difficulties that we have with things like fear, anxiety, greed, etc. These kinds of things also fade away if we can actually tap into that big mind. in a conscious way, where we're fully aware of what is taking place. And that is what we call enlightenment. But of course, big mind is always functioning for each one of us. Right now, it's your big mind. It's not your big mind. Big mind is never your big mind. It's just mind itself, constantly functioning, whether you're awake to it or not. But the one point he makes here, he says big mind is something you have. I would be surprised if I saw the actual transcript of what Suzuki said, that he actually said that. He may have, I don't know. Because that actually is even counter to what Dogen teaches. And Suzuki, being a student of Dogen, I don't know if he would have actually said that. Of course, it could have just slipped out. But the fact is that big mind is not something you have. Big mind is what you are. And we don't have it. You don't possess big mind. In fact, it's the reverse. Big mind possesses you, so to speak. Big mind is you. Big mind, it expresses itself as you. Big mind expresses itself as virtually everything that is going on. That's what we would call big mind. And when you understand at a later time, if you study with me long enough, I'll be showing you some of Buddhist psychology, and you will begin to understand a little bit about how the mind actually functions, what the mind actually is. And you'll see how it is that big mind is producing you. Producing you is sort of an illusion, because strictly speaking, there isn't any you, so to speak. Don't get nervous. Nothing changes. It isn't wink out time or anything like that, so. But our normal take on things, that, I'm sitting here taking in all of this out there, there's something off about that. That's not quite the Buddhist understanding of that. Any questions about what I just said? Yeah.
And the question of unconscious, but it's still not clear, although you explain. There are artists like Picasso who tapped in, obviously, his big mind, but personally, who was not a good person, tapped into his big mind, but then he went out his life being a shambles.
Right.
And everybody around him.
Well, as I was saying, that's kind of an unconscious thing, so we can do that. And in fact, all of us, from time to time, we are tapping into a greater or lesser degree into big mind. But when we're people who are artists, we think of as artists or creative people, they probably have a gift for tapping into this, maybe more than most of us. But it's not necessarily the same thing as enlightenment or awakening. Two quite different things. So then the inspiration is somewhat unconscious. It would seem, but to think that it's coming from a place called the unconscious, that's not a Buddhist understanding, strictly speaking. Kay, you had a question?
Well, you're saying tapping into the mind, that's
yeah, so that it isn't accurate.
Is it more a matter of taking your ego out of the way and letting the mind express?
Ego mind isn't acting. That kind of quiets down. And then big mind can just simply express itself. Yeah, that's more like it. Because, you're quite right. When I say tapping, that gives solidity to the ego. And now this ego is going to tap in. So that's a very good point you make. But I'm just speaking that way now because most of us here haven't really been too acquainted with that. So it gets a little difficult. The more accurate we speak about this, the harder it is to understand what you're talking about. Mary?
Am I going in the right direction? Somehow I'm associating now this big mind with the doubt.
Better be careful there. Yeah, people make that association. Sure. I'm not a Taoist, so I should be careful here. But in Buddhism, we have this teaching called the Anatta teaching, the teaching that all things are without self. For those of you who are going on into the Nagarjuna classes next year, is a teaching of emptiness, that all things are empty of a self. This is a very profound teaching, and it's the foundation of all of the great teachings in Zen, the great wisdom teachings in Buddhism and in Zen and elsewhere in Buddhism. But this you don't find in Taoism. So that's why I'm just saying, be careful of that one. Now, this is a teaching unique to Buddhism. Oh, Chris.
Pardon the use of unconscious again, but is big mind similar in any way to Jung's concept of the collective unconscious?
I wouldn't say so, because, again, the collective unconscious is presupposing that there are these separate consciousnesses that, you know, like there's your consciousness and my consciousness, there's the consciousness of the various people within our culture, whatever, and collectively we're all kind of in step with some unseen, what can I say, mind force here. I don't know how to describe this. What I'm trying to say is that if I understand Jung, and I'm not a Jungian scholar by any means, but it, just in the very term, it's kind of a collection. It's a composite of various things, as opposed to what we are calling the. Put it this way: it seems to me that it's putting more emphasis on the individual ego consciousness. And from a Buddhist standpoint, there is no such thing as this. This is what we call Manas consciousness, and it's actually kind of a false or bogus kind of consciousness. It doesn't exist at all, actually, in reality.
My understanding of what Jung meant with that was the ability in human beings, or the tendency to form certain images or ideas that we all share, the archetypes,
mm-hmm.
and that mm-hmm. seems to me to be a shared tapping into, not necessarily
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that it kind of presupposes the separateness of our different ego selves. In other words, it doesn't transcend this. Whereas in Buddhism, it starts out the other way, that it's all one whole piece.
Okay.
You know, and then the fragmentation or the separateness that's appearing in our experience is a result of the functioning of mind itself.
It's in that direction. I agree.
Yeah, I think he's reaching toward it.
Yeah.
But again, it's without this anatta teaching. And without that understanding, that's our normal way of looking at things, you know. And again, it's the same kind of understanding that, well, I am here, the reality is that I'm here, and then the stuff out there that I'm seeing, that's also real, you know, I'm kind of taking it in. It's part of that general way of seeing, which is quite different than what Buddhism understands and teaches. But the teaching that we need here is a very difficult and profound one, which I teach in the third course that I teach in the first year, the unlocatable self. And for those of you who haven't had that yet, I recommend it. And then that teaching also forms a basis that you will need to go on into the Nagarjuna teachings that I've been teachings about emptiness of self. I've structured these courses in that way because you need to kind of take this step by step if you really want to understand it and go on to the more profound and subtle teachings in Buddhism. And if you ever want to understand Zen, you really need this as a background. But it's a difficult teaching. But you can handle it, intellectually you can handle it even without enlightenment, because that's what we're going to rely on next winter. Now, enlightenment might come, but don't count on it. Usually takes a little longer, but it could.
I wasn't there.
You're right. See? Got some really good students here. Been learning. Yeah, it's not there. You're already there. You're in it. You are it. It is you. Well, anyway, enough of this.
Talking ordinary you or...
Yeah, there's no end to this. Okay, anyway, let's see. At the bottom of page 90, then, this is kind of interesting. He says, we have Hinayana practice with Mahayana spirit. Then he says, rigid formal practice with informal mind. Although our practice looks very formal, our minds are not formal. Well, this Hinayana practice, Mahayana mind, is everybody here, there's probably some of you don't know Hinayana, Mahayana. Anybody not know these terms? Yeah. Okay, I better explain. The Hinayana, I don't like to use the term Hinayana. It's a pejorative term. The people who call themselves the Mahayana, which means Maha, means great, like Mahatma Gandhi, great soul. Mahatma, great soul. Maha means great, right? And Mahayana, Yana is vehicle, so the great vehicle, the great teaching here. So the people who embrace this kind of teaching, they label themselves Mahayana, and then they call these other people Hinayana. Hina means lesser, you know, so lesser, the lesser vehicle. So it's kind of a put-down term. So basically, I don't like to use it. Unfortunately, see, most of the schools that were part of the Hinayana don't exist today, so they can't defend themselves. There's only one left, the Theravadan school. But it's a wonderful teaching, and a good portion of it we'll be studying in the first year. The basic teachings of the Buddha are found there. But this Hinayana, or perhaps, well, I can't really call it Theravadan. I'll have to just call it Hinayana for now. But this Hinayana, he talks about Hinayana with this formal mind. Although the practice looks very formal, our minds are informal. So the point he's making here is that we enter into this very structured, particularly in Zen, we get into a very kind of a formal, structured way of behavior. If we get a place of our own where I can do more teaching in the area of meditation, there'll be certain basic structures that you follow. You kind of constrict your movements to some degree, and you confine your body in the meditation. So it's like we're tightening down, getting very formal. I won't do this to any excessive degree because I don't think that's necessary. But you have to kind of discipline your body, and then you begin to discipline your mind as well. So also the mind begins to formalize in a certain kind of way. It gets less random, spinning off, shooting around, and whatever. But what happens, though, with this kind of a more rigid way of behaving, conducting our movements and the activities of our mind, the mind itself starts to become more supple, more fluid, more tolerant, more magnanimous, more open, less easily offended, etc. It becomes this informal kind of mind, and it comes out of this kind of structured formality of the Zen practice. So what he's saying here is that by entering into this kind of formal practice, the mind itself becomes very fluid and open. It's just the opposite of our normal way, where we tend to be rather sloppy in our behavior. Kick off our shoes, we're not really paying attention where they go, we let the door slam behind us in somebody else's face, and we cut off somebody around the corner as we're driving, whatever, you know, we're not really paying attention to how we speak to others, etc. It's very easy for us to fall into this kind of sloppy behavior. And to the degree that we do, it's all a matter of degree here, but to the degree that we do, and this is kind of our normal way of acting and behaving, our minds become rigid and intolerant and brittle and inflexible. And we get locked into our prejudices, you know, and our likes and our dislikes, and everything in the way we move through the world mentally, everything becomes very hard and difficult and fragmented and sharp. And yet our behavior is kind of loose. Hey, man, you know. So in Zen, we tighten down this behavior, and the mind itself becomes more magnanimous, more open, more tolerant, flexible. So that's what he's speaking here. We have Hinayana practice with Mahayana mind. But then he says a little further down, he said, if you have Mahayana mind, something which people call formal might be informal. So strictly speaking, that this thing that we're calling formal, it looks formal, but it's actually quite informal, because the mind that can actually practice this is a very informal, very flexible, free, tolerant, open, and fluid kind of mind. A mind that actually matches reality itself. As opposed to our kind of rigid, intolerant mind is one that's going against nature, in a sense that the nature, the real world that we live in, is a fluid world, but we become brittle. And this is why this is kind of one of the ways we can describe the source of our problem and difficulty in life. And so in Zen, we just go the reverse. We kind of tighten down our life a little bit. We're watching what we're doing. We're paying attention here. And we limit our activity. We confine it a little bit. Not that you have to do this all day long, but when you actually enter into the practice of meditation, etc., we kind of confine ourselves to some degree. And now the mind itself can begin to become more natural, I guess, maybe what we could say. So we say, observing the precepts in a Hinayana way, is violating the precepts in a Mahayana way. So what he's saying now is that in this Hinayana, getting in a rigid way, for those of you who came through the precepts class with me, if you recall, we talked about this at length, that these are not rules, these are not dogmatic statements, you know, thou shalt not, etc. These are simple descriptions of, well, if you lie, you're off the track. You know, you're causing difficulty for yourself and for others. This is the whole point. Just notice that. It doesn't mean you're bad, you're evil, you know, you're stupid, or no judgments like this. It's just simply that, well, if you engage in deceptive speech with someone, this means you are off the path. It's just causing difficulty. It's as simple as that. It's a simple statement as that. So by watching your speech, you get back on the path, and that difficulty, which comes from this kind of rigidity that we have by loading ourselves up with our prejudices, our different kinds of frames of minds and whatever, this disappears. It dissipates. It softens up, and it turns to smoke and just dissipates. So that's the point he's making here. So observing the precepts in a Hinayana way, what he's saying here is that if we were to observe these precepts as rigid rules, which is easy to do, and the Mahayanists like to point this out to the Hinayanists, that that's what you're doing here. That's a long story. I can't get into the different fights that these schools have had, but that's, they pick on them for that. You know, that you guys are getting a little bit too rigid here in your mind and following this a little bit too strictly. That's not the place where you should be strict. This makes your mind brittle, you see. So the whole Mahayana came by throwing this whole thing in reverse, and all the mind itself becomes subtle. But our behavior becomes more strict. But he said, if you observe our precepts in just a formal way, you might lose your Mahayana spirit. He said, but before you understand this point, you always have a problem. So this is a very subtle point here. And we easily get the wrong idea, because the thing that you see in this practice looks kind of rigid and confined. But the whole point behind it is that this will develop, help you develop a more subtle, supple, tolerant, and open mind. So I don't know. I hope I've made that clear. But that's basically what's going on here. Like I say, the one thing I don't like about this way of expressing it is a little bit too hard on the Hinayana people, even though there aren't too many of them left today. But still, it's not quite fair. Then going on to page 94. In the section Nirvana, the waterfall, if you've read this section, you know, he talks about observing the water, Yosemite, and the water is coming over the falls. You know, if you've ever been to Yosemite and you see these falls that drop, what are they, 1,000 something or other feet here? I mean, it's incredible, some of the waterfalls there. You see the stream of water flowing out over the top, and of course, as the water falls, it starts to accelerate, right? So in effect, it's stretching itself out, because as the drops keep falling faster, they begin to separate out until finally, by the time you get to the bottom of this waterfall, it's just basically a mist coming down. You know, all the water is separated into just tiny drops, and then it collects again at the bottom in a stream, and it continues to flow on as a river. So in looking at that, he uses this as kind of an analogy, that at birth we enter into life here and we're falling, and then we kind of separate out in this way. So at the top of page 94, he says, after we are separated by birth from this oneness of the stream in which all things are actually flowing, you're a stream too, actually. You're just, you know, these water droplets, they don't really define anything. It's just, all there is a stream. And the water droplets themselves are arbitrary. Each one can be, again, yet again, split and split and split. So that's not the reality. The reality is just simply stream, and it's all stream. The droplets themselves are stream. The stream is stream. The medium that they're falling through is stream. Everything is stream. But nevertheless, we can find these different things separating out in the stream. Well, what he's actually talking about, this is an analogy for consciousness. This is how consciousness actually works, or how the mind is functioning as a conscious, as the action of consciousness, if I can put it that way. But he says, after we are separated by birth, we have feelings. So he's really referring to not merely your birth, as you might commonly think of your birth. He's actually talking about the separation that comes out from just the action of consciousness. In other words, suddenly, as we're at some point here, we could say that you are separate from the whole. This is the emergence of your ego self, your separate self. And, of course, everything you view out there is further divided, and you see all kinds of separations out there. We don't quite realize how arbitrary these different kinds of separations are until we begin to look at things more carefully. And we can't really find any kind of true separation if we look at it carefully, because actually it's all of a whole piece. It's really just part of this stream. It's the stream itself, this whole stream, the stream of the whole, so to speak. That is actually the reality. And the separateness, the separate drops themselves are not, no one of them are real unto themselves. And this includes you. This is a Buddhist understanding. So this is what he's referring to here. He says, after we are separated by birth, after we are separated through conceptualizing, we see this kind of, some kind of separateness. Now we have feeling. In other words, now the mind, in seeing different things out there and me here, separate from everything else, we have feeling. There's feeling arises. Because there's some of that stuff out there I like, some I don't like. You know, of course, there's a lot of it I'm kind of so-so about, neutral, you know. But that liking and disliking has appeared. And this is a feeling. And basically what this means is that now we have ego. But he said a little further down, he says, when you do not realize that you are one, you're one with the river, you've never been separated from the river. Or he says that if you don't realize that you are one with the universe, then you have fear. So this is the basis of all our fear and worry and difficulty in life, is the fact that we see ourselves as separate. Well, the seeing ourselves as separate, again, is just simply a functioning of mind itself. And if we don't understand how it is that mind is functioning and creating this kind of separateness, it leaves us with a very profound sense of self, and this is extremely profound. Very difficult for us to see what's illusory about that. And when we don't see what's illusory about that, then the stuff that's out there in front of us or that we confront or whatever, it kind of jerks us around through life one way or the other, for good or bad. This stuff is very real. More real than what actually is real, and that's the part that we're overlooking, is that there, right from the start, there never is, never was any separateness to begin with. This is, and that's big mind once again. So that's the point he's making here. And whether it's separated into drops or not, the water is water. Reality is reality. Our life and death are the same thing. When we realize this fact, we have no fear of death anymore. We have no actual difficulty in our life. And it says, like, life and death are the same thing. And this is what I've said before on other occasions. And we talked about it last week. I believe we talked about the bell, sounding the bell. Wasn't that in this class? Or was that somewhere else? 2 weeks ago? Okay. And we talked about what's real here is the sound and silence together. Same thing with life and death. But because the mind functions, separates everything out, we've separated out now life from death. So we see these things as two separate things. And they each become quite real. And we say, well, for me right now, I'm alive. This is what we say. And then there's that other thing called death. And that's going to happen to me in the future. And, of course, this becomes very frightening to us. But if you understand what he's saying here, and, of course, actually, to really understand what he's saying, this is, involves awakening itself. But what the awakened mind sees is that these things are never separate. That life and death are never separate. All there is this whole stream taking place. It's always been this way, always will be this way, could never be otherwise. It is only the functioning of mind itself that creates the separateness. And once we see that that's this kind of separateness that's occurring is a result of the functioning of consciousness itself, then we're spared a great deal of pain and misery, because we don't see our life as separate from our death. There isn't any hour in the first place. There isn't any life that is separate from death. And no matter how you look at life, it's quite true. You cannot have life, even in our most conventional way of looking at life, you will never see it apart from death. That death is an aspect of life itself. But it's actually even more integrated than you can imagine. And that's the point he's making here. There's never any real separateness. To actually have enlightenment or to see the reality that we are living in, this is also to see at the same time the functioning of mind itself and to realize what consciousness is and to also understand how it is that everything appears to be apart from you. A little further down he said, to attain nirvana is to pass away. To pass away is not a very adequate expression. No, it's not, because literally nirvana means extinction. But extinction, again, doesn't mean what we might think, that something becomes extinct, then we think it's gone. But actually, that's not the case. Nothing becomes extinct in the sense that it's gone. Extinction is something that's really taking place right here, right now. In other words, everything is being born and everything is dying in this moment. This is the reality in which we live. But when we see separateness, now we see, well, the separateness of a thing, and we also see the separateness of its birth and its death. You know, so this thing will die independent of everything else, and it's already cut off from the universe, as we commonly think of it. And then we talk about extinction. We think that, yeah, when this is dead, it's gone, and it's, well, we could say it's extinct. That is not the meaning of nirvana here. This extinction that they're talking about is already with you now. In a sense, you already are extinct. The reason you are extinct is because, well, you never switched on in the first place, you know. So there was never any birth of you in the first place. If you think so, try to find it. You have no knowledge or recollection of where you came from, how you got started. It's completely unknown to you, and you'll never be able to find it. And if you start looking at it, there are ways I can show you this goes way beyond the range of this course, but there are ways we can look at this where you'll begin to see that no matter how you look at it, you cannot find a time when you were not here. Well, of course, your ego wasn't here, your body wasn't here. We can find times like that, but that's not what you are. That's the problem. Basically, what I'm saying is you will never find what you are. Nevertheless, there is this moment. This is always going on. This is the reality in which we live. This is mind itself. Okay? Nirvana is simply the extinction of this ego self. This is what goes out. This is what becomes quiet in a person. And basically what he's talking about here is the actual final awakening of a Buddha or an enlightened person. To attain nirvana is to pass away. Okay, the ego is gone, so to speak. To pass away is not an adequate expression. Perhaps pass on or to go on or to join would be better. Yes, and this is just simply to... Except join still isn't so good because join presupposes that the original... that the separation that we originally saw was real in the first place. And the point is that there was no separation in the first place. You know, you see what I'm saying now? So in the whole field of reality, something gets separated out from it. The moment this happens, it appears that this thing had a birth. Okay? And it goes on for a time, and then it seems to disappear. And then we say that thing died. And we think that is extinction. Okay? But what he's saying here is that, okay, here's the totality. You know, things are constantly appearing like this. But actually, the thing that's real is this totality itself. The different things that are appearing here, no one thing here is actually real and right from the start. Because this thing, whatever you pull out here, is always in need of everything else that exists for its very identity. It's never apart from this. It's never apart from the stream. The droplet, even though it appears now as a droplet for a time being, it's never really apart from the stream. And in time, we're back to just seeing stream again. So there was never any true birth to begin with, not as we commonly think of a birth. Nor is there any true death that we find in the way that we commonly think of death. Okay? What then becomes extinguished? If we actually see that this is the nature of reality, then what actually becomes extinguished, in a sense, in nirvana, is this ignorance that we have about the actual nature of our experience and the actual nature of reality itself. This is what becomes extinguished. Okay? Any questions about that? Yeah.
This has occurred to me many times over the months that I've been attending your lectures, and this stuff is easy in many respects intellectually, but it has occurred to me that if I were to suffer the loss of a loved one, I think all of this would take on a different meaning. And I take it that according to this teaching, an enlightened person would be indifferent to the grief that they might feel toward the death of a loved one.
No, I don't think so, though. There's a story of a Zen master who, when his wife died, he cried. And some people there, they were kind of surprised, you know. Aren't you an enlightened person, you know? Why are you crying? You know that she, you know, there's no death here, you know. And, you know, they're kind of going on like this. This kind of misunderstanding. No, the person died. You know, this is really true. This person died. But the way we commonly think of it, that's not quite what happened. Nevertheless, she died. And so he cried. And they couldn't understand that. And when his explanation was, he says, well, I'm going to miss her. Very normal reaction. Because you see, the fact is that even though ultimately we cannot say that these separations that we find in reality, you're there, I'm here, etc., all the different kinds of, you know, even though ultimately we can't justify that, and ultimately that isn't really what's real here, nevertheless, you are sitting there, I'm sitting here. And this person that I know as Keith, well, I don't know, Keith, who's going to be you or me first, but if you die, that'll make me sad. I'll notice that. I'll see that. And if your loved ones die before you, of course, there they go. And it's very sad. This isn't a denial of that kind of thing happening. But if you think that, if your understanding is that that's it, that actual person is gone, this is a little different now, you know, because what exactly dies here? We see a body that suddenly the lights go out, you know, and the body begins to rot and decay, or perhaps we put them in the ground or we cremate them or something. And that person that we knew in the flesh, we don't run into that person anymore. There's no way of denying this. You know, this is really quite true. But if we think then that that's it, you know, and then what, after death, now we can begin to speculate, well, where did this person go? Is that the end? Or do we say this person is going off to some afterlife somewhere? Well, now we can begin to speculate. We can begin, you know, and we begin to wonder what happened to this person. And you'll never satisfy yourself. No matter how you explain this to yourself, you'll never satisfy yourself. And Buddhism doesn't offer you any story here, you know, that will satisfy you. It doesn't give you any story. But this is where you'll find some satisfaction, and not through finding a story. Because if you can actually see how it is that you live right now in this moment, you will be spared an enormous grief and pain and anxiety. Above all, beyond the fact that, of course, you're going to miss your loved ones when they die, beyond that, one of the things that's really so frightening for us is the fact that, I'm going to die too. I'm like them, you know? But if you really see how it is that you're living in this moment right now, this is the thing that's not going to be the problem for you. Yes, you're going to continue. You are going to miss your loved ones when they die. Certainly. Why not? But that enormous fear and anxiety that you have about you dying, this can be cleared up. Okay? And also in the process of clearing that one up, you can also learn to live in a kind of a detachment, not that you don't have feelings for your loved ones, etc., but you can live with a kind of detachment where you're not completely tossed away and consumed in grief and pain, etc., because you actually understand the nature of reality, that is right from the first, it's just this ongoing flux and flow and stream. So I don't know if that helps you at all. But I know myself that I experienced grief when I had a good friend a few years back died suddenly. And I cried. I was really choked up over that. And, you know, because I missed a guy, you know. But it's different than what I once would have gone through. It was like just having some, like, oh my God, you know, and then just sitting there wondering what.
This is important. It's not like saying, like when we talk about that all things are without self, it doesn't mean like there's no person there, there's no body there, there's no consciousness there, there's no thought there, there's no feelings there. That's not the case at all. And then if you awaken, you realize that, that's not it at all. The conventional reality that we see doesn't diminish in any way. It's still, there's still the same thought, feeling, the world exists in the way that we commonly see it, but we just have a much different understanding of it. I don't know if that helped. Yeah, Chuck?
I think what Keith was saying, I think it kind of goes back to that impression that once somebody awakens, that they've perfected their life,
Yeah.
That may not be true, but actually, the part that I'm trying to...
That's when you can actually start to work on it.
Yeah, that's...
Because then you finally, now you know what you're doing. Before that, you can get instruction from someone. But it's better when you know what you're doing yourself.
So the part I was trying to kind of work through the cracks on was, suffering's actually a great fuel to sometimes, staying in the present moment or being very paying very attention to that present moment. So a place you can survive if the suffering is great, because there isn't any suffering. I guess I'm trying to sort that out, though. I mean, the Zen master, he has an ordinary life, but that really was an ordinary statement, was it not?
Oh, yeah. I'll miss her. You mean, is that what you're talking about? Yeah.
But if...
So it's like when my friend died.
Yeah.
I missed him. It was a shock to me. He was in perfectly fine health, and he died like that. It was a shock. Young man. That choked me up.
But the suffering really can't be there if one is right there.
No.
Whatever that might be, 1 second. One Dharma moment or whatever.
No, I think you misunderstood. No, the suffering is there. You feel the pain. But this is what I was trying to get at.
The pain or the suffering.
But you can deal with it. It's transmuted in a way.
Isn't there a simultaneity to it? Not one, not two?
What do you mean?
Well, in trying to grasp how you can have insights and still experience discomfort. Is there simultaneity to this? We're not separate.
Yes.
We're enlightened at this moment, and yet we're delusional at the same time.
Yeah, you could put it that way. And that's what I was trying to say, is that our ordinary world doesn't disappear. It doesn't wink out. But by seeing beneath the facade of the illusion that we suffer from, this whole thing has shifted in a profound way, and we're not tossed away by it any longer. That's all. I don't know what else I can say, really. Yeah.
The point that's striking me at this moment is that the bereavement is unavoidable, but through being mindful, you become more independent.
Yeah. That strength is right there within yourself. And you realize that you truly are not dependent on any other. And you see that. Of course, you aren't even now, but we don't know that. And in our confusion, we're relying on other things. And when some of these things kind of go on us, that's the part that we can't handle. And that's what's so difficult about this. And, of course, the big one is, well, this is going to happen to me too, And we have a hard time handling that one. Of course, most of us are pretty good at not really looking at that. But what I'm saying is that with awakening, when you actually see what's taking place here, that there actually isn't anything that really goes, that there actually isn't anything that really comes. When you see that, you have a radically different take on this. I don't think we're going to get to it now tonight, but he talks about this later on. I was hoping we'd get to it. Where basically you're living in solitude, alone. This is the reality of our lives. This is the reality of your life right now. You are alone, even though you're surrounded by other people, you have loved ones, etc. But the reality of your life is that you are alone. But if you can, and this is a fact, whether you're locked up in your ego or you're awake, you are alone. But if you're locked up in your ego and you realize that you are alone, or suddenly you're made to think that because a loved one that you've been depending on suddenly disappears, this becomes an intolerable situation. This becomes horribly frightening, horribly difficult. Suddenly that loss is there. You reach out. If you're lucky, you've got others that you can fall back on. They kind of support you there. And then gradually we kind of get through that one and another. And this is kind of how we go stumbling on through life. But what I'm saying is that the awakened person, you, this realization that you are alone, is that you are not alone as an ego. You are not alone. The true reality of your life is that you are not alone as yourself. You are alone as reality itself. In other words, you have transcended your ego. You are alone, but you're alone as all beings. And when you see it in this way and all things are dropping away, sure, you miss a friend. Yeah, it's very natural because you still have the same ordinary thing. But the way that you would react to this now, you will never be tossed into these earth-shattering, you're just completely, you know, well, where your whole life is just being ground up and you go insane, and you go crazy, and you're lost in grief for 10 years and this kind of stuff. This just won't happen to you if you actually see. But, of course, there's no denying effect that, yeah, your loved ones, some of your loved ones are going to die before you. This is just, who can deny this? It's really true. And what I'm saying is that if you're caught up in your ordinary understanding of things and you see yourself as separate, as an ego, this makes this kind of reality that we live in unbearable and horribly frightening and very difficult. But when you realize that there never is any separation, if you actually can see it in that way, and if you do, it is so real that you can see the illusion. And once you see that, you're spared that extra dimension of suffering, which is the one that really, really hurts. That's that. Well, you haven't had the talk on the different forms of dukkha, but that is the third form of dukkha or suffering that is so profoundly painful and difficult for us. This is the one that becomes eradicated. You still stumble. You stub your toe. You cut your finger. I mean, the bee stings. It still hurts. You still have these kinds of pains. But with this profound understanding, everything has shifted in a way that now you can really deal with life. So I don't know. This is kind of a big topic. We'll look at this in more detail in some of the other classes that I have, but probably enough on this right now. I think I'm just going to move along a little more quickly. A few things I want to get to here. At the bottom of page 94, near the bottom, it says, everything comes out of emptiness. I just want to say that I don't know if I would put it this way. My understanding is that everything is emptiness. And for those of you who are going to be studying Nagarjuna next year, that's what we're going to be looking at, emptiness, that teaching. But he says, everything is emptiness, meaning empty of self, empty of some solid, unchanging aspect of your being. Everything is empty of that. Before we realize this fact, everything that we see is just delusion. So everything that you see, everything you think, my teacher used to say, whatever you think is delusion. It's really true, because you cannot think. If you're conceptualizing, then there's separateness here. And that's delusion. Delusion is the separateness. The awakening is the wholeness, the oneness. Well, the actual awakening is the realizing that the delusion is still sitting there. So it's both the separateness and the oneness. But before we realize this fact, everything that we see is just illusion. But toward the end of this section, he says that on the next page, he says, when you realize this fact, you will discover how meaningless your old interpretation was. How the way that you commonly explain the world to yourself is utterly meaningless. When you, particularly for those of you, if you get to the Nagarjuna next year, you're going to have a really good dose of how meaningless your ordinary way of looking at everything is, you know, and the way you put things together. It's very useful, handy, serves a great purpose, but it's ultimately meaningless. And we kind of know this in the back of our minds, you know, and so we have unless you're a very devout believer in something and you're very naive and you really believe in this thing, whatever it is, there's this doubt lurking in the back of your mind, and we don't really pay a whole lot of attention to that. But Nagarjuna will help you find that. But when you start to realize how meaningless everything is that you put together in your mind, it's fine though, because as long as you remain within the world of of delusion, the world of concept, whatever, this is all very handy and useful for you, you know, to get along in life, etc. It's nothing wrong. It's nothing bad. Buddhism isn't going to try to snuff this out or anything, but you have to see what that is. Otherwise, you make the mistake of taking this kind of relative stuff, the stuff that you believe in, the stuff that you think about, and you try to find the basis of your life in that, and you won't find it there. And if you try to base your life on anything within that collection of stuff that you have in your mind, the structure of a thought or, you know, this explanation, this belief, this whatever, it'll always let you down. It's always shaky, and it'll always fall apart. And so in the end, we find that our life is basically meaningless. And if we do get to that point, then of course we're filled with despair. You know, so basically we either have to become some kind of a zealot believer in something, you know, and devoutly believe in something. And this can only go for so long before sooner or later you kind of, you'll wise up to it and you realize, no. And then the other thing is that we just go way over to the other side. Now we're filled with despair. There's nothing. There's nothing to hold on to, nothing to grasp, nothing to, you know, there's no reality, nothing, everything is meaningless. And then we despair. Two wretched extremes. And it seems like, at least for those, a good many people now, we're so well educated now in the 20th century, good many of us are wandering around in this area of despair, and we find ways to kind of entertain ourselves, you know, keep ourselves from getting too lost and despairing or whatever. But it seems like we have no choice. It's one or the other, you know. And I can't be a devout believer in this, but at the same time, then I have to live with this despair that our life is meaningless. Well, what we don't understand, Buddhism, if you understand the teaching of the awakened, you don't have to go to those extremes. There's another choice. It's not so easy to spot, but there's another thing you can do here. And that is that the only reason you're either clinging over here or that you're ending up in despair is because you have from the beginning, how can I put this, you have been taken in by, and you are momentarily even now, in an ongoing way, we're taken in by the stuff that we see and the stuff that we think and the stuff, in other words, the kind of stuff that the mind is producing through conceptualizing, through dividing up the world here and there. There's this and there's that. And we keep looking for reality within the stuff that we divide up. If you understand from the start that nothing is divided out in that way, that you're not going to find any kind of meaning within any one of these things, then you won't go searching for it. Or after you've gone searching through a good many of these things, you end up in despair saying, well, none of this is going to work. You won't fall into this trap. So in other words, basically, I guess what I'm saying is that the only reason we fall into the meaningless thing, life is just utterly meaningless, the only reason we fall into that is because we were looking for meaning in the first place. If you just stop doing that and just start paying attention to what's actually happening in this moment, you will be utterly fulfilled. Totally fulfilled. That's true. Well, you'll be fulfilled in the sense that you're not there. You're not there feeling cut off. Okay, well, page 99, he said, instead of having a deep understanding of the teaching, we need a strong confidence in our teaching. Yeah, because you kind of know, how do you get an understanding of this teaching anyway? It's kind of... It's not a teaching that is that easy to grasp. He says, so instead of having a deep understanding in the teaching, we need a strong confidence in our teaching, which says that originally we have Buddha nature. In other words, originally we have true nature. You know, that originally we're in reality right now. Okay, our practice is based on this faith. And I want to say something about faith in Buddhism, faith in Zen. It is not at all like, for example, most of us, I suppose, are familiar with Christianity, living in this culture. And in Christianity, the word faith, you know, big F. Big capital F, in big letters. Faith is a central issue in, actually not just Christianity, but I would say probably most religions. But in Buddhism, faith is pretty tiny. It's not central, really. It's just kind of a backdrop to what it is that you're going to do. The faith that we have is not in some belief. The faith that we have is not in some story about something unseen, or that, well, after you die, this will happen to you, or whatever. We don't put faith in anything like that at all. Faith in something that can be told. Faith in something, in a word or a phrase or a book or a teacher or anything of this sort. We don't put faith in something out there like that. We don't put faith in other. Well, of course, we don't put faith in self either, in the sense of your ego self once again. The faith that he's speaking of here, that we have to just allow ourselves to kind of relax and sink back into, is faith in the fact that this is real. This is genuine and true. And what I mean by this is just simply this. What is going on here right now, this is not... You might be a brain in a vat. Nobody could prove that you're not. I mean, there's some evil scientist. It's just all these little probes in the brain makes you have visions of things and you're hearing things. And so it seems like you're in it. Sure, fine. But we can go even beyond that. That's doubtful. You know, maybe you are just a brain in a vat. But the point is that there's something genuine and real within this experience. In other words, something is going on. This is what we have faith in, that something's going on. And the reason we have faith in this is that this isn't like a leap of faith. This isn't even a belief. All it is just notice. This is not blankness. This is not nothingness. There's something happening here. Okay, we have faith then that whatever it is that's happening, if we don't label it, if we don't single it out, if we don't try to explain it to ourselves, now we can put utter faith in the fact that something is happening. Now, the moment we begin to try to offer some explanation, now we're taking a leap of faith. Now we're beginning to tell a story. Okay, in Buddhism, we don't do this. We don't take that leap. We just rely on the fact that something's actually happening. And now what we do, the focus in Buddhism, and particularly in Zen, is what is happening? What is going on? What exactly is it? This is where we start. We start with the actual raw experience of this moment. We don't make any presumptions that, well, I am having... No, we don't. Already an assumption there, a story. The story was I am... We've gone too far. See, so Buddhism will pull us back to this very rudimentary state of this actual moment that we're in. And now there's something we can do. We can begin to pay attention to what's going on. And here is where we will find reality, and within finding what the actual reality of this moment is, we transcend meaninglessness and all the rest of it. And we're spared a great deal of pain and misery, because the pain and misery that we experience in life is, basically through telling ourselves a story. The most profound story that we have is that, well, I am. I exist. That's not exactly what's going on. That you can prove, anyway. Leslie?
I just want to make this quick. I don't want to take up all your time, but this is hard for me. This is the part of it that's hard for me, because it's such a contradiction in my mind, because Christianity is a leap of faith, as mm-hmm. far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind
yeah.
of what it's about.
Yeah.
And if Buddhism or Zen is saying that, this is reality or this is here, mm-hmm. that is there, how can you be doing both things at once?
No, we don't say that is there.
Well,
there isn't any that or
okay,
there.
Well,
that's speculation. There's just this. The fact
so
that there's
you
a...
you can do both?
What do you mean do both?
I mean, you can be... This is where I'm getting really...
Oh, can you be a Christian and be a Buddhist?
Yeah, I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Like,
oh, absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you can be a Christian and be a Buddhist, and I don't know if you can be a Christian, but you can be a Buddhist and be a Christian. I don't know if you can be a Christian and be a Buddhist. But no matter what, because see, Buddhism isn't saying, oh, that's a false belief. That's wrong. You go to that church and you believe in that God. That's ridiculous. Buddhism doesn't talk that way. It leaves you alone utterly. With that, it's just fine. Go ahead and do your life. Live your life. Whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, a communist, a Christian, a Muslim, whatever. Go ahead and do it. the point in Buddhism is never mind that part. I mean, you go ahead, live your life, but let's learn to focus on this moment. See what's happening, and you can you're a devout Christian. You go to church every day. Continue to do that. Buddhism isn't going to say stop believing that, but it's, you're going to learn to see what's actually happening in this moment. As a result of that, I suppose your beliefs will begin to shift and change, perhaps in a way that they wouldn't had you not been learning to pay very close attention to what's actually taking place in this moment. But at no point is Buddhism going to start kicking out stuff. It doesn't have a doctrine in that way. The whole point of Buddhism, and Zen in particular, Zen is about the very art of learning to get into this moment and seeing it for what it is. If there was any seed of any kind of, telling you, well, this is what you should be seeing, you know, this is how it is, well, now we've got a belief system again. And we're back on the very track that Buddhism has been it's been discovered that a human being can find, your way to truth. How are you going to find your way to truth? Here we are, we sit down, we're in this mysterious place. How did I get here? I don't know how I got here. And people tell me this, people tell me that. My mother said I was born so many years ago, that's fine. But does that answer everything? And no, and there's always this question, that question. And finally, you get to a point where we have to ask, if we're really interested in pursuing this, what's this all about? I mean, what's going on here, you see? Now we get to this question. Now here's where Buddhism picks it up. And what Buddhism says, let's start to pay attention. What's really happening in this moment? And the faith in Buddhism, I'm saying, is that we'll find the truth in this moment. We don't find the truth in the teaching. The Buddha himself said, my teaching is like a raft. It's like a finger pointing at the moon. It don't get caught up in my teaching. When you've used this raft, this teaching, get rid of it. These words are not holy. Well, this is Suzuki, but if it's the Buddha speaking here, the Nikayas, the writings of the Buddha, well, he didn't write, but the teachings of the Buddha, they're not holy. And so we don't presume that we're going to find the truth in these teachings. These teachings are about helping us find truth in this moment. That's where we find the truth. We don't find it in words. We don't find it in teachings. We don't find it in concepts. And the only kind of faith that we need in Buddhism is that faith there, that, yeah, if I really want to get to the truth, to me, in my mind, that doesn't require a leap of faith. Maybe it does in yours, I don't know. But it seems to me, yes, of course, if we're ever going to know what's going on, we're going to have to start paying very close attention to what's actually happening. And then we can find out. So that's what the meaning of faith is in Buddhism.
Probably get a lot more out of the sermon.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. See, like in the second year of teachings, where we go through Nagarjuna, well, I shouldn't be talking about this too much because some of you won't be doing this year. But what we do there, in a very skillful way, we really hone this part down where we really learn to observe very carefully what's going on in our mind from moment to moment and how this thing comes up. And Nagarjuna show you that it hasn't got a leg to stand on. This thing comes up, nothing to stand on here. And then this comes up, nothing to stand on. And he does this repeatedly. So you start to wonder, what's his point? What's he saying? Because, like, what's he trying to hold up here that isn't going to be vacuous? And he never holds up anything. He just keeps holding up all the stuff that you think and you believe. Until finally, you kind of catch on. Because Buddhism never gives you the point. The point is found in your life, in this moment. And that's where we find it. So this is a skill that we can learn. And it's not exactly easy, but on the other hand, if you're really kind of tired of being kind of stupefied by everything that's going on and you want to get to the bottom of it all, this is the way to do it. I kind of want to get on here a little bit. On the next page, he says that the spirit of your practice should not be based on an egoistic idea. And once again, so the spirit of your practice can't be based on this kind of separateness. It has to be based on the actual experience, which happens to be, I'll tell you now, I don't want you to take it on faith, but the actual experience that you have is unified. And if you look at it long enough, you begin to realize that that's the case. And we call that experience, perceptual. That's your perceptual experience, which is always ongoing, and it differs from your conceptual experience. They kind of go on together. Concept, when you conceptualize the world, you split it, you you see this as opposed to that, you form an idea, a story, whatever. These things are so inviting to us. They're so, what's the word I want? Anyway, they just captivate our minds because they're so compelling, you know, and they seem so real. But, in fact, what's really real is not the individual things that get pulled out like that by the mind, but what's actually real is the whole piece that we started with, and that's the actual experience that you're in. And so this practice, Zen, is to come back into this actual experience. You'll see it as a whole piece. When you actually see it as a whole piece, then you're awake. And you'll notice that because you see it as a whole piece, one of the pieces being you is no longer seen as being real. Anyway. When we have no idea of ego, and that's what he's talking about here, then we have a Buddha's view. So this is the view of awakening. This is to be awake. Our egoistic ideas are delusions covering our Buddha view. Okay, then he gets into karma here. I wanted to say something, but I think I better let it go. We'll talk about karma in some other courses. Karma, by the way, just means willed action, by the way. People have a misunderstanding about that. At the bottom of the page, he says, if our practice is only a means to attain enlightenment, then there is actually no way to attain it. Okay, so our practice is not a means to enlightenment. That's what we commonly think. But if you're going to practice to become awake, then you will never awaken. You can continue to practice with that idea because that's very ordinary. Gradually, we'll take you through this until that idea that you have begins to weaken and weaken and weaken. And if it disappears, and then you can still practice, most people at that time, they give up. I don't know about most people, but many people do. But I hope you don't. But you get to the point where you're practicing for no reason. You're studying this for no reason. You're just doing it. And that's when you can wake up. But if you still have some gaining idea, you're going to get something out of this. You're still keeping yourself separate from what this teaching is really trying to point out to you. Okay, I think there were some things further back. Well, emptiness, the section on emptiness, 110. Emptiness, again, as I've mentioned before, that's the teachings of Nagarjuna, out of which Zen came. The blurb at the beginning of that section, he says, when you study Buddhism, you should have a general house cleaning of your mind. Well, that's what I was saying earlier, that Nagarjuna, he keeps pointing out, you know, this is what you think. Okay, take a look at this. Doesn't have a leg to stand. So he says, you just keep pointing out all the different things that you think, and we clean it. We just clean it out, you know. And boy, when you start to dust it off, you realize it was all dust, you know. All of this thing, you start to dust this object here, and it's just dust. There you go. He cleans it all right. He cleans it till there's nothing left. Well, anyway. But it says here, if you want to understand Buddhism, it is necessary for you to forget all about your preconceived ideas. This is that thing we talked about before about you can't have anything in your cup. You have to first empty the cup because nothing will go in otherwise. To begin with, you must give up the idea of substantiality or existence. Yeah, as long as you think that these things, that these separate things that we find in the world are substantial and real, then you're going to be captivated by those things and you will miss the single-pointedness, the unity, the wholeness of the actual experience that you're having from moment to moment.
Sounds an awful lot like quantum physics to me.
Quantum physics? Really? Well, there are parallels, but I don't know if I want to get into that right now. We've only got 3 minutes left here. It says on page 113 at the top, this is an interesting point here. He says, concentration is not to try hard to watch something. It's not to try hard to watch something. Yeah, we do this in our meditation where we're trying hard to focus on some particular thing. This is not so good. And for those of you who had the meditation class with me, you remember we talked about this, not to focus. The Zen way is, when they talked about that, they look for the sign within the breath. That was in the Hinayana practice, the Theravadin practice. The book that we were using was Theravadin. And that was one of the main points that I differed on, if you recall. And here he speaks of it right here. Concentration means freedom, so your efforts should be directed at nothing. You should be concentrated on nothing. In Zazen, we say your mind should be concentrated on your breathing. But the way to keep your mind on your breathing is to forget all about yourself and to sit and feel your breathing. If you are concentrated on your breathing, you will forget yourself. And if you forget yourself, you will be concentrated on your breathing. Well, what he's saying, gradually this will work its way into a kind of meditation that we'll take up at a later time that I teach later on. It's called Shikantaza. And this is where we get into the meditation of just sitting there itself. If you focus too much on the breath, you create that sign of the breath at the tips of your nostrils or whatever, like it was in that other class for those of you who took that. As I was saying then, in that class, you will always keep yourself separate from this object. And the point in, if you want to understand the emptiness of all things and the emptiness of yourself and the inseparability of yourself from everything, that you are alone within this universe as the universe itself, etc. If you want to have this understanding and this realization of the experience that you're having, which happens to be your true experience, you can't persist in a practice that keeps some kind of separateness there. And so this is why when we look in our meditation, we're not focused on a particular point. I've made this point in meditation instruction, just to remind you in case you've forgotten, that we look in a general area. We don't close the eyes. We don't leave the eyes wide open. We're kind of half open, half closed, looking in a general area. We are aware of the breath coming in, the breath going out. We have a general awareness of the whole body sitting here breathing. This is all very, very important because this will allow us to get to some finer points in meditation that after you've been experienced with meditation for a few years, if you continue to study with me, then I can point out some more subtle things within the meditation. This kind of transcendence of seeing yourself as separate, pulling yourself out from the whole, which is the source of all our pain and confusion. Well, I'm sorry, I had a few more points. Believing in Nothing, page 116. This is fantastic. I guess I won't be able to say it, but at the beginning he says, I discovered that it is necessary, absolutely necessary, to believe in nothing. And this is kind of what we were talking about a minute ago, that we don't insert something there, we don't put something there. That is, we have to believe in something which has no form and no color. That's what we're talking about, this right here, this, but that there's something actually happening. There's this moment is switched on, so to speak. It is not a blank nothingness. Okay, something's going on, but it has no form, no color. Of course, we're seeing forms, we're seeing colors, we're having thoughts and concepts, etc. But the actual experience is a whole piece here. Has no form and no color, something which exists before all forms and colors appear. He says, believing in that. Well, it's just, that's that faith again. Having faith that this is an actual, this is the reality of your actual experience. Finally, I want to say a little bit about original Buddhism on page 125. Very quickly, I just want to say this. This is where I wanted most of my talk to be over here, actually. But he says, according to Dogen Zenji, the Soto school is not one of the many schools of Buddhism. He says, usually people put an emphasis on some particular position or some particular understanding of Buddhism, and they think this is Buddhism. But we cannot compare our way with the practices people normally understand. Our teaching cannot be compared to other teachings of Buddhism. Also, on the next page, Dogen did not call himself a Soto teacher. He said, other people may call us the Soto school. Soto, by the way, is a particular school in Zen. Zen has basically five different schools, Soto being one, which is where my training was in. He said, other people may call us a Soto school, but there is no reason for us to call ourselves Soto. You should not even use the name Soto, he said. There's another place where Dogen said something like this. He said, who speaks of a Soto sect? He says, I tell you, it's a devil that speaks of a Soto sect. You know, something like that. I wish I could find that quote, though. But the point I want to make here is that, again, seeing this kind of divisiveness, separateness, we carry it right on into the different kinds of schools and teaching to separate even Buddhism out from other things. Buddhism, this is what I was saying before about Christianity and Buddhism. If you're a Christian, you'll see yourself, because it's the ordinary way to see, you're a Christian, and you're not You're not a non-Christian, and you're certainly not a Buddhist, you see, so you probably see it in that way. But if you really understand Buddhism, you don't see any separation here. You see, so it's open in this way. So to truly be a Buddhist, you can't even be a Buddhist, you see. And this is also the meaning of it. And here we're talking about forming this school here and all that. And yes, okay, it's basically Zen. All right, it's Zen, you know. But I want to be gentle with this and to try to find ways to not separate things out. I mean, I myself personally, I've done enough of this. I'm I'm trying to stop that in my life, and I don't want to create an organization here that's going to be separate and vying with others and pushing others out or whatever, any of that. Just forget all that. No, let's just sit down and find a way to focus on this moment and to come into this moment and see what's actually going on. This, I want to make the focus of what we're trying to do here. I regret that I ran out of time. I really had a lot to say about that, but I hope I got the central point across there. Anyway, we have gone over. I'm sorry. Hope to see you guys in September. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.